Major underwriting for The Infinite Mind is provided by the National Science Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
I'm Dr. Fred Goodwin, and this is The Infinite Mind. When does enough become too much? This week, we look at hoarding, the inability to throw out stuff, lots of stuff.
In extreme cases, none of the furniture in the house can be used. Sometimes people with this problem can't sleep in the bed because it's full.
Understanding that it's a treatable illness that really requires intense therapy is very important.
We'll hear from people with this clinical condition.
My house looks like the city dump.
And how one compulsive saver reacts when a friend helps him clear up.
It feels like the maid was here, but a maid with a dumpster.
Plus tips from a decluttering expert.
If I don't love it or use it, I should get rid of it.
All coming up today on The Infinite Mind. I'm Dr. Fred Goodwin. In our township, there's one day every year that you can throw out anything and everything, and they'll take it away for free. As luck would have it, this year our Throw It Away Day came right in the midst of preparing this show. While my difficulty discarding things doesn't reach the level of clinically significant hoarding, my experience of throwing out stuff resembled what you'll be hearing about on this show. First, I couldn't have done it without the help of somebody who happens to find it easier to let go, my wife. But even with her help, it was still a struggle, my imagination working overtime on the almost endless possibilities. Something that's outlived its present usefulness could someday be just the thing I needed to make or fix something. Or back issues of Commentary and the New Republic, their articles reminding me of things I want to study further, or someday write about. The old psychiatry books, what if someday I wanted to write a history of psychiatry, and so on. Well, in the end, we did get rid of a whole lot of stuff, and I conquered my anxieties. How? I cheated a bit. You've heard about 12-step programs? I took a 3-step approach, stretching it out over a year. First, we had a new room built, which absorbed much of the clutter from the rest of the house. Then came the new garage, just in time for the overflow from the new room. So there it was, all the stuff in the garage, out of sight, out of mind. I had thrown it out, sort of. I could handle throwing it out into the garage, because I knew I could still change my mind and rescue it later. Sort of like the recycle bin on my computer. And then our town came along with the prod, the extra incentive, the once-a-year opportunity for a freebie. And, step three, it was done. As I looked at the almost empty garage, I actually felt a sense of accomplishment and relief. Now the car could fit. I came away with a new appreciation of how clinical conditions can teach us something about ourselves. In this instance, how characteristics that can be assets, attachment and the capacity to see new possibilities, can be carried to extremes and become disabling. It's those extremes you'll be hearing about today. Later in our show today, we'll talk with the co-author of a treatment plan that many compulsive savers call their Bible. We'll meet a neuroscientist who's pinpointing where in the brain the problem may originate. And we'll learn what happens when a successful events planner drafts a friend to help him clean house. Also, a decluttering expert on what makes clutter, clutter. We'll start today by visiting a compulsive saver at her home on Long Island. Frances is 70 years old, and she says she's had problems with this all her life. She's only recently been diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder.
I've been hoarding a long time. I've been cluttering a long time, more than actually hoarding. They sort of go together for me. My house looks like the city dump. It's all trashed. There's a lot of clothing around, a lot of books, records, papers. I can't really do anything because I feel like I have to go through each bag because there is important stuff mixed in with junk stuff. The abundance of stuff around me makes me feel rich. And another thing that always hits my thinking is that there'll never be enough. Like, I have trouble with that. It's like my hoarding means security to me. And if I hide something, like if I put something in the closet, it's like out of sight, out of mind. So I have to see everything. It has to be out in clear view. When I try to throw something away, it's like I always think that something may be valuable. I've had this thinking since I've been a little child. My parents always were afraid to throw something away that it would be valuable. I went to my doctor and they diagnosed it, and then they sent me to see a therapist. They put me on medication and gave me assignments to do, and that seemed to help a lot. And if you have a friend or family member and they're hoarders, the only way you can help them is not to criticize them. And don't throw stuff out without their permission, because that really hurts them and they go backwards. Because that's what happened to me. I was doing well until I went in the hospital and my daughter and other friends cleaned up the house for me. But when I came home, there was a lot of stuff missing and it made me feel abandoned. I joined a list on the internet, and that's called OCD, Hoarding and Cluttering, and it's just like H-C. And it's comprised of about 50 or 60 people that all have OCD and have, mostly it's for hoarders. And what we do is we support each other and we help each other with making goals, little baby steps. It makes me feel less alone and to know that I'm not the only one with this problem. I don't have a role model, and I'm trying to be a role model to myself and to other people so they can overcome this at a young age and enjoy their life more.
Our first guest today has pioneered research into hoarding. Dr. Randy Frost is professor of psychology at Smith College. He's the co-author with Dr. Gail Steckety of a treatment plan that many people struggling to overcome this problem regard as their Bible. Dr. Frost, welcome to The Infinite Mind.
Thank you, Dr. Goodman.
To begin with, what is hoarding?
Well, hoarding is a problem that really consists of three things. The first is a behavior, which involves the acquisition of and failure to discard possessions that appear to other people to be useless or of limited value. But what happens when someone develops a clinical hoarding problem is that it's coupled with cluttered living spaces that are so cluttered that it precludes using those spaces in the ways in which they were designed. And the third component is a significant amount of distress or impairment that's caused by the hoarding behavior and the clutter.
What sort of distress are we talking about?
Most often it's considered part of obsessive-compulsive disorder, which is listed under the anxiety disorder. So we do see a lot of anxiety in people who have this problem. But we also see a lot of depression. Many times when considering whether to throw away a possession, the feeling is much more one of grief than of anxiety. What we see in this behavior, this problem, is really three manifestations of it. The first is a problem with compulsive acquisition. People who have hoarding problems tend to compulsively acquire things, either by compulsive buying or the compulsive acquisition of free things, including flyers, giveaways at stores, and sometimes even going through other people's trash.
So this is a matter of degree. Are we talking about a spectrum here, or is there a clear distinction where you can say you have this one symptom and that's clinical and the rest is just part of the normal spectrum?
Well, from what we can see right now, it looks like most of these behaviors are on a continuum, that we see people with acquisition problems that are mild all the way to severe, and the same with saving problems, that is the inability to throw something away, which is the second feature of this, the second manifestation. And sometimes we see people have a little bit of a problem with it, and sometimes we see it so severely that the person can't throw anything away, even pieces of trash in their home. But there's a third component that's also a problem with disorganization. There is a problem with being able to organize these possessions so they all end up in the middle of the room.
That's interesting, because you ordinarily think of a compulsive person as somebody who's very highly organized and has categories for everything and makes lists of everything.
Yes, and what we see is a funny kind of relationship between organization here and disorganization, and it has to do, I think, with the way in which information gets processed by people with this problem, that they pay so much attention to the details of things that they have difficulty abstracting larger categories from the details. And if you can't categorize something, it makes it very difficult to organize things.
Maybe you could help our listeners understand the difference between the clinical and the normal by describing a hoarder's house for us. What's it like?
Sure. In most cases, people who have a severe hoarding problem, they can't use significant parts of their home. They can't use the stove because it's covered with things. We've had people in our studies whose stoves were full. The ovens were full of things that they were storing, so they couldn't cook. They couldn't use their kitchen table because it was full. The chairs in the kitchen couldn't be used. In extreme cases, none of the furniture in the house can be used. Sometimes people with this problem can't sleep in the bed because it's full. Sometimes they can't use the bathroom. They can't use the bathtub because it's full of stuff.
What do we understand about the psychology of this?
We think there are five major kinds of deficits or problems that are associated that help the development of this. And the first is something I mentioned a minute ago, and that's information processing deficits, having to do with attention. That is, what kinds of things are paying attention to when someone looks at an object and tries to decide whether to throw it away. What happens is there's a great deal of focus on the potential value of the possession. That's different than people who don't have this problem. Another information processing problem has to do with this ability to categorize that I mentioned a minute ago. A third has to do with some memory deficits. One of the things we find is an intense sort of reliance on visual cueing for memory.
I'll forget this if I don't have the thing right there in front of me.
Exactly. So we see people who have hoarding problems whose drawers and closets are empty and all the stuff is in the middle of the room. One of the things we see that has to do, again, all with under this rubric of information processing deficits, has to do with decision making. We see people with this problem have very difficult time making any kind of decision, not just about possessions, decisions about what to order at a restaurant, what to put on in the morning. And it has to do with the way in which information gets weighed and evaluated. And it seems as though what happens is that every piece of information gets looked at and given an equal level of importance. And because of that, it becomes difficult then to make any kind of decision.
Now, another common clinical situation that I encounter is grief. When somebody's lost a loved one, they can often just get into these patterns where they constantly rearranging their desk or constantly holding on to things, almost as if they've had such a profound loss, any little loss is too much to bear at that particular moment. Do you see that?
One of the emotional attachments that we see quite frequently is some kind of grief-based attachment, where it's almost as though the possession has become a part of them, part of their identity, and getting rid of the possession makes them feel like they're losing a piece of themselves.
Could you give our listeners some clinical examples of that?
Well, sometimes one woman we were working with had an art history book, and we were trying to get her to think about selling it, and she put it into the sell category and immediately began weeping. And said, when I asked her how she felt and what she was thinking, she said she just felt like dying. She just felt like she wanted to die. It was very extreme. And the book she had identified as one of her special books that she'd kept for many years, but she'd never read it. She'd never had it open. But somehow the attachment to that book was so powerful that she felt that grief when she got rid of it. Interestingly enough, within 5 minutes, that feeling was gone.
Now, are there some other general characteristics that we haven't yet covered before we go to a caller?
Well, one of the things that we also see are beliefs that develop about possessions, beliefs about responsibility and waste, that somehow ownership carries with it a responsibility to make sure the possession gets used, or at least not wasted. It's almost as though if I see an opportunity out there that's invested in a possession, somehow I have to take advantage of that. And that we see playing out in compulsive acquisition. And all of these things tie into what we think of as the reason behind the behavior, which is an avoidance behavior. What they're avoiding is making decisions. They're avoiding the distress associated with the difficulty of discarding and making those decisions and so forth.
We have a caller on the line from New Jersey. Lucille, how can we help you?
Hi, Dr. Goodwin and Dr. Frost. You just described me to a T. I have a question regarding heredity. I want to know where this came from. Do they know the generation link, and does it follow a specific line? In other words, every other generation? I just need to know where I got it from. My mother died when I was born, so I really don't have her to look at as to know if maybe it came from her. And also, I have a 5.5-year-old daughter, and I need to know, like, when to start looking for signs of it. You know, when does it show itself? Because with myself, I think I had it longer than I've been diagnosed.
Dr. Frost, that's a very important question. Can you help her?
Yeah, Lucille. We're not quite sure how this gets transmitted. One thing we do know is that it seems to show up more often in first-degree relatives of people who have this problem. In fact, there have been a couple of studies that suggest that up to 80% of people with this problem grew up with someone in the household who had a saving problem, or maybe not clinically significant, but some degree of a saving problem. Now, we don't know whether that transmission is genetic or whether it's modeling or something else.
Well, would one suggestion for Lucille to, in terms of her own help, that her daughter not see that and not model that, and that gives her an extra motivation to try to clean things out and get somewhat beyond this?
I think that's probably important. Having a model who can go through the process of making decisions about what to keep and what to throw away.
Do you get more anxious when you do start throwing things away?
Oh, yes, I cry every time. But I have to know that the reality of it is it's okay. I know it'll pass, and it's just not important. And if I keep telling myself that, I hope, I'll start believing it.
I think you've hit on something that's very important from the standpoint of the treatment, and that is learning how to tolerate that anxiety until it goes away, and that's the key.
Well, Lucille, thank you very much. Those were very interesting questions and comments.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Good luck, Lucille.
Okay. We now have Sandra from San Francisco. Sandra, how can we help you?
Good morning, Dr. Goodwin and Dr. Frost. Thank you for the program. I also have attention deficit disorder, and I've been a member of the San Francisco Hoarders and Clutterers group for a year. What works in support groups and what doesn't? Do we just support the hoarding and cluttering characteristics?
Well, I think there's always that risk that in support group ends up being one where everyone sort of supports what it is they're doing at the moment. I think the most successful support groups are ones that develop a plan for each member to try to clear out a part of their home. And I've seen support groups that go to each other's homes and meet in someone's home and work with them around a particular room. And those, I think, are especially effective.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Sandra. That was a very interesting question.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye now. Well, we have a caller on the line now, Jim from San Diego. Jim, how can we help you?
I have an issue with medication. I've been on most of the SSRIs and am finally on one that seems to work, but the SSRI or the medications don't seem to cure my hoarding and cluttering tendencies, but they seemed to be able to help me to better focus on working on my hoarding and cluttering tendencies. Perhaps Dr. Frost could comment on how much behavioral therapy by starting small and maybe working up to larger tasks can be more beneficial in overcoming hoarding and cluttering tendencies.
Dr. Frost.
One of the things that we've seen with this problem is that the treatment takes quite a long time compared to treating other OCD symptoms where you can get some relief with behavior therapy in 8 to 12 weeks. With hoarding, it generally takes a little bit longer, and that's because the progress that one can make initially is fairly small. The anxiety and depression that's experienced when trying to throw something away is almost overwhelming at first. So small segments of working with someone are what start the person going. And medication can help speed that process along, we think, in being able to calm people down when they're initially trying to throw things away. We're working on a treatment protocol now, and the times when we found it most effective is with someone is with the person who has the hoarding problem in their home, spending time going through possessions and trying to make decisions about them. One thing that's crucial is the person not actually do any of the discarding, that the person with the problem does everything, all the decision making, all the discarding, and the coach is there to really help them work through the decision making process. It's not a person who's coming in to help them clean.
Dr. Frost, you call this an excavation session, and you've written about that. Could you describe for our listeners what a typical excavation session would be like?
Well, what we normally do during these sessions is we try to select a target area and a type of possession within that target area. So we might select the kitchen table and more particularly select books on the kitchen table to start with. And then what we do is create a small number of categories for that possession type. Usually for books, we have three categories. One is books to sell, one's books to put on the bookshelf, and the other is books to put in storage. So whenever a book is pulled out, it has to go into one of those three categories.
Jim, have you been through one of these sessions?
I actually have, and I believe that the protocol that Dr. Frost is describing now is one that's beneficial, and I also applaud his comments about the person who is suffering being the one that makes the actual discards. I know in some of his writings with Dr. Steckety, they talk about conflicts that can arise when a family member or quote-unquote friend tries to assist by, well, we'll just clean things up and throw things away. And I know from a personal basis that the anxiety caused for the sufferer can be so overwhelming that you shut down.
Mm-hmm. Jim, any stories about you? Have you had those kind of shutdown experiences?
Unfortunately, yes. I have found on a personal basis that I can have my friends do the sorting for me and perhaps go into the categories that Dr. Frost has just described so that I then go through the three stacks and say, yes, I agree with this, so I can be working concurrently with my helpers. But I make the final decision, and once we came to that understanding that I was making the final decisions and they saw that I could make the final decisions, we've been working along much, much better and get a lot accomplished.
Dr. Frost, how can loved ones help? How can they be helped?
Well, I think one of the most important things is to start to come to a different understanding of this problem. Most people who have this problem and have not pursued figuring out what's going on have some funny ideas about why many of them feel like they're just so different from everyone else in the world and they really beat themselves up over this problem. And so understanding a little bit about how these behaviors are all tied together and how anxiety relates to them and learning some of the strategies, some of the things you have to do, even though they're difficult, some of the things you have to do in order to get through this problem, I think is an important component.
Okay, well, that Jim, that was a very good series of questions and comments, and we appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your call. Well, I think that's a good place to wrap this up. Dr. Randy Frost is a clinical psychologist and professor of psychology at Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts. For more information about hoarding as a symptom of obsessive-compulsive disorder, you can reach the Obsessive Compulsive Foundation at 203-315-2190. That number again, 203-315-2190. Dr. Frost, thank you so much for joining us on The Infinite Mind.
Thank you.
To reach our guests, link to internet sites related to this show, find out about upcoming shows, or hear The Infinite Mind in real audio, you can visit our award-winning website at theinfinitemind.com. Or you can share your comments or read what others have to say about this show on our new message board. Again, you'll find that on our website at theinfinitemind.com. I'm Dr. Fred Goodwin, and this is The Infinite Mind. Coming up in our second half, Dr. Sanjay Saxena discusses the latest research on the neurobiology of hoarding and what happens when one compulsive saver enlists a friend to help tackle his apartment.
I say I want to live with less, and yet I can't, throw it out, and I can't do it on my own.
There's lots more, so stay tuned. I'm Dr. Fred Goodwin. Today on The Infinite Mind, we're talking about hoarding, when accumulating stuff becomes just too much. The Infinite Mind is produced by Lichtenstein Creative Media in association with WNYC New York. Next, we visit the jam-packed home of a man who recently came across his to-do list for 1980. On top of the list, get rid of half my possessions by the end of the year. More than 20 years later, he's finally ready to tackle the job with a little help from a friend. The Infinite Mind's Devorah Klar reports.
Jeff has every New Yorker's dream apartment. It's in a great location. It gets a lot of light. It has a lot of space. It even has closets. But the apartment is overflowing with stuff. Over the last month, Jeff, who asked us not to use his last name, has been trying to clean out his apartment. But still, he has a collection of over 3,000 videotapes, drawers full of pens, a closet crammed with at least 80 shopping bags, 1,000 books, boxes and boxes of fabrics and silk, research articles from old jobs dating back 20 years, and stacks of notebooks with only 2 sheets left.
I say I want to live with less, and yet I can't, throw it out. And I want to be that person, and I can't do it on my own. My dream of having a clutter-free space did not start yesterday. It has been with me forever,
Jeff is seeing both a psychologist and a psychiatrist, and while he's taking an SSRI for his depression, neither of his doctors have diagnosed him with obsessive-compulsive disorder. His doctors see his fear of throwing things out as an inability to let go of the past. Jeff says he feels that his success lies in the past, and that the only way he can experience his success is to look at old scripts he's written or old awards he's won. He's now the senior creative director at a major advertising agency, but he's also been a chef and a theatrical producer. He even produced music festivals for the White House. He doesn't want to let go of those memories.
I have piles of stuff there that I am concerned are going to go out, and they're going to be a little piece of me that's going to go out in the trash. You know, I don't have a sense of what it is to live with less, because I never lived with less. So I grew up in a place where everything was saved of my house. Nothing got thrown away. Even the kitchen that was not used in the kitchen, my father installed in the basement. They couldn't even throw away the old stove and the refrigerator and all that.
Recently, Jeff decided he had to get rid of his clutter. He's about to adopt a child, and so he wants to make room. Jeff says his therapist wants to come look at his apartment, but he doesn't want her to. Not yet, anyway. Instead, he turned to his friend, Jane, for some immediate hands-on help. Jane happens to be very organized. Their friendship goes back 20 years.
How would I describe it? Probably my dearest friend. He's a wonderful friend for anyone. He is imaginative, creative, enthusiastic, likes adventures. He'll take on something new.
Jeff invited Jane to spend an entire weekday decluttering his apartment. They agreed she would do it without him. Some of his things she would throw in the garbage, and some she would give away to thrift stores. The rest she would put in a box and wait for Jeff to look over when he came home in the evening. So, that Wednesday, Jeff set out to his job across town. He trusted Jane, but still he was worried. Every time he began to panic about what might get trashed, he'd remind himself that he wants to do this, and then he'd relax to a state of only mild nervousness. Meanwhile, back at his apartment, Jane rolled up her sleeves. Here she is in his bedroom, where she found a dusty old box full of...
lots and lots of magazines. This is 1995, and actually I think it's like about cars. Auto insurance, 1995. Now, I have a hard time why anyone would keep that, because auto insurance over the past 6 years, I'm sure, has changed dramatically. I'm probably going to opt to put this in the garbage. Yeah, ooh. And the reason when I'm going, ooh, it's because there's dust, and you can tell nobody's picked these up for at least 5 to 6 years. So some of these magazines are here from, like, 1980. I'm not talking about he kept a year's worth. We're talking about years' worth.
Jane says she enjoyed cleaning out Jeff's apartment, but she wonders how he'll react.
My hunch would be he's going to come home, he's going to go, oh, like, wow, it looks good.
I met up with Jeff at the end of the day.
I think the blood is going to drain from my body. I will be upset. I've already been through the apartment. I don't want to throw away anything. I don't want to. So this is a challenge. Now we're getting closer to the apartment, and I see garbage on the sidewalk here, and I'm looking to see if any of it is mine. Here we go. We're here. I feel like I'm facing the ultimate challenge as to having the life I want as opposed to having the life I used to have. I asked for this. Jane is also proud of what she does, and I don't want to hurt her. I'm here. Oh, look who's here.
Oh, hi.
Hi, Jane. How'd it go?
It went.
Jane then took Jeff to his kitchen.
Where should we go? Oh, my God. It feels like the maid was here, but a maid with a dumpster. Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Do you notice something majorly missing?
Well, bags. Oh, magnets.
And not on the magnets, but what about those bags?
Those bags are gone. I'm just looking at everything that's missing.
But for Jane, the job wasn't done yet. Together, Jane and Jeff determined the next step. They decided to choose a year, say 98 or 99, and all the magazines and all his papers before that year would have to go. The two of them sat on a red leather couch in the corner of his now decluttered apartment. Jeff just found out that even though his apartment still looks packed, outside the building there are about 25 garbage bags full of all his things, his 20-year-old scripts, his 10-year-old folders, his empty gift boxes.
I'm feeling fine.
But your mind is racing to the garbage can, trying to figure out what could have been in the 25 bags.
Right? Yes. And why wouldn't it be? Why wouldn't anybody feel that way? I mean, I don't know. Wouldn't you wonder what was thrown out if it was 25 bags of stuff? I'm happy that they're gone. I've got the two sides at war. The side of me that wants to keep it, and the side of all of it, every bit of it. And then there's a side of me that really does want to lighten up and wants to move on. I feel like the good person, the stronger person, is winning. I think that there will be times in which I will say, I cannot believe we don't have that. See, I'm in pain, but it's good pain. It's like a vestigial organ. You didn't need it anyway. Oh, it's like getting a haircut.
Except we don't want it to grow back.
For The Infinite Mind, I'm Devorah Klar.
Earlier in this program, people who save compulsively have shared their stories, and we've explored some recent gains in understanding and treating hoarding. But what is happening at the neurobiological level that makes it so difficult for people who hoard to let go? Our next guest, Dr. Sanjay Saxena, is spearheading research into the biology of the obsessive-compulsive brain. He's director of the Obsessive-Compulsive Disorder Research Program at the University of California at Los Angeles and associate director of UCLA's Anxiety Disorder Program. Welcome to The Infinite Mind, Dr. Saxena.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Dr. Goodman.
Nice to have you. Now, it seems like scientists have only very recently begun to understand causal factors in hoarding and to develop treatments for it. Why do you think it's so little has been known for so long? What's your sense of that?
My sense is that the behaviors and the problems have been around for perhaps hundreds or thousands of years, but that the reason that people haven't really investigated it is because the patients weren't coming in for treatment. And even now we see that. A lot of times people with severe hoarding problems don't realize that they have a treatable problem. They don't tell their clinicians or family doctors about them. And so it was very difficult to get a population to study.
Do you think it's some shame with it, or people just assume it's normal, or what?
No, I think many people with severe hoarding problems are ashamed of their behavior. They don't want people over to their house. They don't want to tell people about it. And they often have a lot of conflicts with their family members about it. But they often feel that they don't want to change it either because they're comfortable with it.
Okay, now what is the current state of research? We'll go into some detail about the neuroscience in a minute, but just what's your sense of the overview? It seems to have become a more active area now?
Yes, certainly has. There's been, in general, a stronger drive in the field of obsessive-compulsive disorder research to identify symptom factors or discrete clusters of OCD symptoms that may have different inheritance patterns, may have different response to treatment, and may have different neurobiological underpinnings. And hoarding is one of the four or five main OCD symptom clusters, and it seems to be different from the others in a number of important ways. Patients with primary hoarding and saving problems don't seem to respond as well to the standard medications that work reasonably well for other OCD patients. They don't seem to respond as well to the standard behavioral approaches, and there appears to be perhaps a unique family inheritance of hoarding, in that if you look at family members of people with severe hoarding and saving problems, they have a very high rate of hoarding and saving behaviors in the family. And they have some elevated rate of other OCD symptoms too, but it's mainly hoarding.
Let me go back for the sake of our listeners to give them a sense of what are the main different clusters. You said it's one of four or five clusters in the OCD, and I guess you can have OCD without having hoarding, and you can have hoarding without having OCD.
That's right. Hoarding can appear in a lot of different states. It can happen in people who are developing Alzheimer's disease or other types of dementia. You can see hoarding behaviors in patients with severe psychotic illnesses, such as schizophrenia. There may be even hoarding behaviors in eating disorders or in mentally retarded populations. But the kind that we're really looking at is the compulsive hoarding that's seen primarily in people with obsessive-compulsive disorder.
What are these other OCD symptoms that tend to associate with hoarding?
The main sorts of clusters of OCD symptoms include about four or five main ones. The most common includes aggressive sexual and religious obsessions that create a lot of anxiety and doubt and usually lead to checking compulsions.
Give us a clinical example for our listeners of what a checking compulsion is.
For example, it might be someone who has to check the door locks 15, 20, 30 times a day for fear that they might have left it open and that a burglar or a thief might come in. So those sorts of, you know, worries about harm coming to oneself or other people. So that's the first cluster, the most common one. The second one is the one that people know a lot about, which is contamination obsessions, people being afraid to touch things without washing or cleaning because they're afraid of getting contaminated. The third main cluster includes symmetry and obsessions with arranging and repeating compulsions. For example, people who I have to spend hours and hours arranging the fringe on the carpet so that it's aligned just perfectly, and can't leave the house to go to work unless it's done just right. I'll have to order their clothes in the closet perfectly and get very upset if anything is moved out of place. Now, all of these behaviors we can see in ourselves and, you know, in people without OCD. I think what's happening in OCD is that there are adaptive behaviors that have gone extremely awry and have become way out of control. And the fourth main cluster includes hoarding, saving, and collecting symptoms. People who are saving and accumulating enormous amounts of things that most other people would be able to discard. And it's usually because of fear that if they discard these items, they'll be left without something very, very important or valuable.
Now, it sounds like there's a thread going through here, something about fear of bad things happening.
Exactly. That's really the common theme of all types of obsessive-compulsive disorder, is that whatever repetitive behaviors or compulsions the person may demonstrate, the behaviors are really due to fear of something bad happening.
Do these people walk around being anxious all the time?
Generally not. In fact, one of the real prominent features of obsessive-compulsive hoarding is that the patients avoid anxiety by not throwing anything away. So the anxiety is only experienced if someone confronts them and says, here, you have to clean out your house, or why don't you get rid of these 10 piles of newspapers that are 30 years old. Then the person may become anxious, distressed, even angry, and want to hang on to them. People who suffer from hoarding problems have great difficulty making any sort of decisions. Sometimes even simple decisions like which brand of cereal to buy in the grocery store or which clothes to put on in the morning.
This suggests frontal or prefrontal brain areas, the parts of the brain we call that have the executive functions. And I understand you're doing some neuroimaging that might shed some light on this.
We're currently doing a research project that is using both structural and functional neuroimaging to look at the neurobiology that might be associated with compulsive hoarding. So we're scanning patients with both MRI scans that give us a nice picture of brain structure, as well as PET scans, or positron emission tomography scans, that allow us to measure brain functioning. And what we're really trying to find out is, are there either structural or functional brain abnormalities that underlie the hoarding behavior? And are those abnormalities the same as we have frequently seen in other people with OCD, or are they different? You know, is obsessive-compulsive hoarding a neurobiologically distinct group or disorder?
That's a fascinating question. Do you have any preliminary ideas about that?
It looks like, when you just examine the MRIs of people with obsessive-compulsive hoarding and compare them to the MRIs of other people with OCD who don't have hoarding problems, in the hoarding group, there are a larger percentage of the patients had MRI abnormalities. Sometimes it was odd shape of the frontal lobe. Sometimes it was mild atrophy of the frontal lobes. And it's not to say that everybody with hoarding problems has these problems, but probably in our series so far, we've seen it in about 40% of patients. So that may be a clue into what's going on.
So it might be that something about this indecisiveness or this dysfunction of executive function might be more specific to hoarding than it is to OCD in general.
That's correct.
Is it, are we at a point where we might consider this a separate diagnosis if you have differences in brain imaging, admitted they're preliminary, if you have some evidence that breeds true genetically, should it perhaps be a separate diagnosis?
Well, I think the evidence is too preliminary to know that, but I think over the course of several years, if different studies all find similar findings, that there are clear differences between compulsive hoarding and other types of OCD, then it may get to that point where we define it either as a special subgroup of OCD or as a separate but related illness.
You wonder whether some of these increased difficulties in treatment, at least with the pharmacological models, are that the drugs that help anxiety aren't particularly good at sharpening cortical function, whereas the drugs that sharpen cortical function, like stimulants, can actually make anxiety worse.
Mm-hmm. That's sometimes the case. And what we're finding is that generally the people who come into the study with compulsive hoarding problems also have other associated anxiety, depression, and other OCD
So if you gave them Ritalin to help their thinking better and thinking more clearly and being maybe even stimulating their ability to make decisions, that Ritalin might spill over into making them more anxious.
Sometimes, but not always. Even in patients with attention deficit problems, sometimes giving the patient stimulants actually makes them calmer because it's stimulating their executive control systems that allow them to inhibit the anxiety a little bit better. So we actually are combining stimulants with the standard antidepressant and anti-obsessional medications quite often to see whether that combination will be useful for people with compulsive hoarding. Hoarding and saving symptoms were a very specific predictor of poor response to the serotonergic agents such as Prozac, Paxil, clomipramine, etc. So it's clear that something more is going on there than that isn't addressed enough just by those agents. And we're in the process of testing out several different classes of medications to find out whether any of them might have more effectiveness in obsessive-compulsive hoarding.
Do you think there's anything out there that's in the pipeline that might target these kind of symptoms?
There are certainly drugs that are in the pipeline that may be used for OCD in general. I don't know of any particular medications that are being designed specifically for hoarding and saving.
What do you think the general public and family members need to know about hoarding?
Well, I think, number one, they need to understand that it's a very common problem, a lot more common than we previously recognized, and that it's treatable. One of the things that friends and family members often feel and bother the patients about is that they think they're just being lazy. They think if they really tried hard enough, they could clean all these things up and get their lives together and not be so scattered, when in fact they're not really appreciating that these folks have an illness that makes it extraordinarily difficult for them to do that. So understanding that it's a treatable illness that really requires, you know, intense therapy and potentially medication treatments is very important.
Okay, well, I think that's a very good place for us to wrap this up. Dr. Sanjay Saxena is director of the Obsessive Compulsive Disorder Research Program at the University of California, Los Angeles, and associate director of UCLA's Anxiety Disorders Program. Thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Saxena, on The Infinite Mind.
Well, thank you very much. I really enjoyed being here.
To find out more about compulsive hoarding, Dr. Saxena, or how to be part of his study, log on to our website at theinfinitemind.com. You'll also find links to message boards for chronic clutterers and compulsive savers. Again, that's theinfinitemind.com. Next up, The Infinite Mind's Emily Fisher interviews author Denise Lin, who has helped thousands of readers free up their homes and minds.
Not everyone has to contend with the sorts of disorders and illnesses that compulsive saving and hoarding are associated with. But many people have firsthand experience with a less severe version of hoarding, garden variety, everyday clutter. Denise Lin helps people to optimize the flow of positive energy through their homes and businesses using a Chinese art called Feng Shui. She is the author of Feng Shui for the Soul and Sacred Space, Clearing and Enhancing the Energy of Your Home. She joins us today to talk about how clutter affects us and to give us tips for getting rid of it. Welcome to The Infinite Mind, Denise.
Thank you.
Let's cover the basics first. What is Feng Shui and how does it relate to clutter?
Feng Shui is an ancient art that was found not only in China but in many cultures that dealt with how we can arrange our homes and situate our homes such that we have better fortune. And how it relates to modern day clutter is this ancient art form has evolved and gone through several processes to where a lot of people are finding it's appropriate for modern day living. And one aspect of Feng Shui has to do with clutter and understanding how clutter can diminish our potential in life and even have a effect on our health, our relationships, and the way we see ourselves.
So when you say that Feng Shui is an art that has to do with arranging our houses and homes and businesses in a way that's going to optimize the flow of good fortune, Does that mean fortune in all the different areas in our life?
You know, it does. And I think part of the reason why this occurs is we tend to identify with our homes. When you go over to someone's home and they run around and say, oh, I'm sorry, my house isn't clean, it's because on some level they identify with their home, or the person who runs into a burning home to save some possession, in that moment they identify even more strongly with their possession than their body. So when we have our identity, our home, and when it's really cluttered, then often there is a corresponding effect where we feel cluttered or bogged down. I call clutter clearing modern day alchemy. Most clutter does have some symbolism to us. So when we clear it out of our space, this has an effect on our psyche.
That's really interesting about the symbolism. I want to ask you about that. Can you talk a little bit about the symbolism of clutter and tell us how it relates to the different areas of our life?
I'll give you an example. I went into a home of a woman who was single, and she desperately wanted to be in a relationship. And as I walked around our house, and our homes can be very telling about our the blockages in our life, our limitations, also our dreams and our dashed dreams, if you will. And everywhere I looked were small gatherings, and almost very cluttered gatherings, of single women figurines. And over again was a metaphor for being single. And she was shocked when she saw it. And as we went room to room, there was again a repeating metaphor of being single. And when she began to clear away some of these symbols and began to replace them with pairs of things, a photograph of two people walking down the beach, she found that sometimes clutter clearing seems to act almost in a mystical way, that she found at work that the men that she was interested in started to return her interest.
In talking about this woman in this one example, she has all these figurines of single women around. What makes that clutter instead of, say, an interesting collection?
Clutter is very individual. What is clutter to one person is not clutter to another person. And you can walk into a room. I've walked into homes that seem completely pristine, and the people say, oh, excuse the clutter. And I'm thinking, where's the clutter? And you can walk into another home. In fact, I know a woman that does clutter clearing seminars, and I walk into her room, and it looks really cluttered, but it's not clutter to her.
What makes somebody hold on to these possessions that really aren't doing them much good?
There are lots of reasons why people have clutter. Probably the biggest reason is fear. People will have fear that, everything's fine now, but I might not have enough in the future. And this can often be a self-fulfilling prophecy, because when you have that idea that I'm not going to have enough, that will tend to be what you create. People that expect to have a great day will often have a great day. They expect to have a lousy day, often they'll have a lousy day. But clutter can represent other things. It can represent security, kind of a cushion against life. In the same way that people will eat a lot and gain weight, people will put a lot of clutter in their house to kind of cushion themselves or protect themselves against the world.
That's really interesting, because in researching our show about hoarding, we're finding out that those are the same reasons why people who are compulsive savers will hold on to things. They'll have a sentimental attachment to it, or there's the idea that I better hold on to this because maybe it's going to come in useful someday.
What happens is often, it's a really interesting thing that occurs, is when people begin to clear out their clutter, often what they'll find is that item that they haven't used for 20 years, the next day after they've thrown it away, they need it.
Can you give us some of the positive effects of clearing out the clutter?
People who are having problems with finances, for example, I suggest that they go and start clearing the clutter associated with their finances, whatever they associate with it. Maybe it's their old bills or their old receipts that have stacked up in the corner that they haven't looked at. Someone who's having problems with relationships, maybe family relationships, I suggest they go through their photographs. A fantastic exercise that anyone can do to get a sense of what they need to do in their home. This has to do with clutter clearing and with feng shui. It's to simply close their eyes and just allow themselves to relax. You might even want to play some soft music. And then imagine that you are walking through the home room by room. And in every room, first notice how you feel. And also, go object to object and notice, does that object make you feel great? Do you feel good looking at it or touching it or holding it? Or does your energy go down? And if your energy goes down, take a look and notice if there's any negative associations with that object. We almost get unconscious about a lot of the objects in our home. Also, when you do this exercise, sometimes something can be great in one area and it's not great in another area. So you might even imagine if there's something that makes your energy kind of feel bad, move it to another area and see how you feel about it in that area. A good thing to tell yourself over and over again, if I don't love it or use it, I should get rid of it.
So in a way, the if you don't love it and don't use it rule could be a definition for clutter. If I don't love it and I don't use it, it may be clutter.
What you gain by keeping that object is usually a lot less than what you lose by having it, having to worry about it, having to clean it, having to move it, having to look for it. So get rid of it.
That seems like a really great place to wrap up. Denise Lin is the author of Feng Shui for the Soul and Sacred Space, Clearing and Enhancing the Energy of Your Home. Thank you for joining us on The Infinite Mind.
Thank you.
To learn more about author Denise Lin, log on to our website at theinfinitemind.com. Commentator John Hockenberry is on a book tour this week for his new novel, A River Out of Eden. He'll be back with us again next week. To reach our guests, link to internet sites related to this show, find out about upcoming shows, or hear The Infinite Mind in real audio, you can visit our award-winning website at theinfinitemind.com. Or you can share your comments or read what others have to say about this show on our new message board. Again, you'll find that on our website at theinfinitemind.com. If you want to be a part of a telephone survey of listeners regarding the infinite mind, send us email with your name and phone number to lcm@lcmedia.com or call us at 212-765-6600. Please make sure to leave your name and phone number. Your input is important to us. Again, that number is 212-765-6600, or send us an email at lcm@lcmedia.com. Next week on The Infinite Mind, the top 10 discoveries in neuroscience. We'll tell you about the new and exciting advances in the world of the mind. Join us. I'm Dr. Fred Goodman. Each week, we explore the new frontiers of the infinite mind right here on this public radio station. Thank you for joining me on this journey.
For a copy of this program on audio cassette or a printed transcript, call Burrell's Transcripts at 1-800-777-TEXT. That's 1-800-777-8398. Or visit our award-winning website at www.theinfinitemind.com. If you have a comment about The Infinite Mind, a suggestion for a future topic, or would like to be a caller on an upcoming program, please call us toll-free at 1-888-350-MIND. That's 1-888-350-6463. The executive producer of The Infinite Mind is Bill Lichtenstein, series producer June Peoples. This show was produced by Emily Fisher, associate producer Devorah Klar, technical direction by Gregory Seaton, development and outreach Tammy Burgess, production coordination Tamara Morris. Dr. Goodwin's assistant is Joanne Davis, office support Erica Gonzalez, original music Art Labriola. Our engineer at WAMU in Washington is John Holt, legal services David LaBelle, accounting services Ackerman and Associates, announcer Katina Kalin. Major underwriting for the Infinite Mind program, Hoarding, is provided by the National Science Foundation, America's Investment in the Future, and by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Support also provided by Eli Lilly and Company, Pfizer Incorporated, and Abbott Laboratories in the form of unrestricted educational grants. Special thanks to listeners like you for additional support. The ideas and editorial content of the Infinite Mind represent those of the producers and guests, not our underwriters. This program was produced in association with WNYC New York and the New York Foundation for the Arts. The Infinite Mind is a nonprofit production of Lichtenstein Creative Media Incorporated. Copyright 2001.